From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Unholy love, evil love. In the year 1820, there were living in the village of Lugvan, near Penzance, a man named William Polgrain and his wife Sarah. They were an ill-matched couple and frequently quarreled. William, who was many years older than Sarah, was morose, irritable, miserly, and absurdly jealous. He hated any kind of amusement and spent most of his time indoors, sitting by the fire, counting his money and reading the Bible. Sarah, on the other hand, was very high-spirited and loved company. At the annual fair, she met a handsome young horse dealer, popularly known as Yorkshire Jack. They had drinks, and from that time onward were constantly seen together. Polgrain got to hear about it and forbade Sarah to see Jack. She declared that she would see him as often as she pleased, and when Polgrain struck her, she knocked him down, sat on him, scratched his face, and beat him unmercifully. The next-door neighbors, hearing his cries, came to his rescue and pulled the infuriated Sarah away from him, but not before she had punished him very severely. After this, Yorkshire Jack came to the house frequently, and whenever Polgrain remonstrated, Yorkshire Jack held him while Sarah horsewhipped him. She told John Rogers, another of her lovers, that her husband was a jealous old fellow, and that if he continued to grumble when Yorkshire Jack came to see her, she would thrash him first and then settle him once and for all with 2 pennyworth of white sugar. The following day she brought arsenic and Penzance, pretending that her home was overrun with mice. About a week afterwards, Polgrain visited a surgeon in Penzance and complained of giddiness and pains in his stomach. The surgeon gave him medicine and came to see him. A few days later, he died. The surgeon who attended him believed that his death was due to cholera and gave a certificate to that effect. Soon after his funeral, rumors of foul play began to be circulated and became so insistent that the local authorities had his body exhumed. On examination, enough arsenic to kill 3 people was found in it. Sarah Polgrain was arrested, tried, and found guilty and sentenced to death. The case against her was most damning. It could scarcely have been more so had she been caught in the act of administering the poison. In prison, she exhibited no indications of repentance, but expressed an ardent desire to tear to pieces certain of the witnesses who had testified against her. She hoped that she would meet her husband in the next world in order that she might give him another sound beating. The execution was at Bodmin. At her request, Yorkshire Jack was permitted to speak to her on the scaffold. Just before the death cap was put on her head and the fatal noose was adjusted, she looked earnestly at Jack and in slow measured tone said, "You will?" After a little hesitation, Jack replied quickly and nervously, "I will." She kissed him. They then separated and he joined the eagerly awaiting crowd. The executioner performed his grim task. The crowd cheered and the black flag was hoisted on the flagstaff. Jack was never the same man after the execution. He became taciturn and low-spirited. He told several of his friends that he had sworn, whether living or dead, to marry Sarah Polgrain, and that he was in constant dread of her coming to claim him. At the advice of his friends, he went to sea. It was of no avail. He was still in constant terror of seeing Sarah. His shipmates used to see him looking over his shoulder at something which they could not see. When they were lying in their hammocks, they were aware of something very eerie and horrible close beside him. This state of things continued until they were once again off the Cornish coast and a storm arose. Yorkshire Jack was standing on the deck talking to one of his shipmates. Suddenly his face blanched and he pointed in terror at the sea. His shipmate looked in the direction he indicated and saw the tall, luminous figure of a woman in black gliding over the foaming, crested waves. She drew momentarily nearer and nearer to the ship. All the crew were now on the deck. They stood gazing at the apparition, too appalled to say a word or utter a sound. Yorkshire Jack gave a fearful cry. "It's Sarah," he screamed. "She's coming for me. Drive her away. For mercy's sake, keep her from me." He threw out his arms to ward her off, staggered, and fell heavily on the deck. For some minutes, none of the crew moved. They were far too frightened. When they summoned up the courage to examine Jack, they found that he was dead. Sarah Polgrain had claimed him. For many years, her ghost was said to haunt her husband's grave in Lugvan. She was seen during the night, robed in a winding sheet, its luminous white face convulsed with evil passions, digging furiously in imitation of the man who had disinterred Polgrain. Stories and legends of men falling in love with lovely, heartless spirits are not confined to Germany. James Bowker, in his Goblin Tales of Lancashire, relates the following story of a man who fell violently in love with a beautiful hill and moor spirit. One fine morning, Giles Roper was returning to his Lancashire home from Fair Snape Fell, when he came to a spot which was much dreaded because it was reputed to be haunted by a very dangerous ghost. He saw a tall, slender girl in white with gleaming golden hair sitting on a boulder. She was so lovely that he was enraptured. He had never dreamed that anyone could be so beautiful. She smiled provocatively and beckoned to him to come to her. He needed no second bidding and was within a few feet of her when she mysteriously vanished and he found himself confronted only by the gaunt black rock on which he had been sitting. He went home madly in love with the beautiful apparition. The following night, instead of visiting the miller's daughter to whom he was engaged to be married, he went to the Fair Snape Fell in this hope of seeing the lovely phantom that had so enchanted him. He was not disappointed. She was seated on the same rock, and when she saw him, she smiled invitingly and held out her white arms to greet him. The same thing happened. He was close to her when she suddenly vanished. He went home more infatuated than ever. The miller's daughter upbraided him for not coming to see her and insisted on knowing the reason. When he told her that he went to the fell to see the ghost that haunted it, she did not believe him and paid men to shadow him. They followed him to the fell and saw him hold out his arms and run towards an invisible being. When they reported what they had witnessed, the miller's daughter felt relief, but was at the same time apprehensive regarding his sanity. She spoke jestingly to him and tried to persuade him to visit her as usual in the evening instead of going to the fell, but it was of no avail. His infatuation for the lovely ghost increased. He went to the fell night after night until he became so ill that he was obliged to keep to his bed. In his delirium, he kept appealing to the spirit with the golden hair and blue eyes to come to him and love him. Before he had quite recovered from his illness, he rose from his bed one cold, misty night and stole quietly out of the house. He was found in the morning at the fell, lying on the ground in front of the haunted boulder, dead, with a look of the most frightful horror on his face. Obsession and Possession. During a railway journey from New York to Buffalo, where I was dated to give a talk in the winter of 1934, I met the Reverend Peter Power, with whom I chatted. He had traveled much and had led an eventful life before he became a priest. One of the strangest stories that he told me was the following. His kinsman, the Reverend Michael Power, was sitting alone one evening, about the middle of the last century, in the parlor of his little house in a remote district in the southwest of Ireland. He was very tired. He had visited many of his parishioners, some of whom had been more than usually tiresome. He was deeply engrossed in a book when there was a loud knock at the front door. A gruff voice asked if he was at home. He had forgotten to instruct Mrs. Murphy, his housekeeper, to tell anyone who called that he was out. Wondering who the caller could be and hoping that it was not anyone whom he particularly did not want to see, he put his book aside and was standing with his back to the grate when the door opened and a tall man in a dark suit stepped into the room. "I am sorry to disturb you at this hour," the stranger said, "but the matter that has brought me here is very important. My name is Randall Beecham." Father Michael scanned the stranger closely and decided there was something queer about him, an element of a disturbing and unusual nature. He was seemingly of middle age with dark hair streaked with gray and strong marked features. There was a look in the deep-set brown eyes that showed the mind was in a harassed, strained state. Father Michael bade him sit down and explained the purpose of his visit. "I hardly know how to begin," Beecham said. "What I have to say is so very peculiar. You believe in obsession, don't you?" "Why, yes," Father Michael replied. "I most certainly do believe in possession and possession. Is it about obsession you want to talk?" Beecham nodded. "Yes. But before I begin my story, let me say a few words regarding my home and family. I am a widower with one child, Elise, a girl of 17, who will be leaving school at the end of next July. She is spending her Christmas holidays with me. 18 months ago, I lost my wife. We had had a very happy married life and were devoted to one another. You can imagine how I suffered when she was taken from me. The blow was so overwhelming that for some long time, I was quite unable to concentrate on anything. I missed her terribly. Had it not been for Elise and my work, I'm an artist, I should have committed suicide. Father Michael looked shocked. And jeopardize your chance of going to heaven? I did not think or care about that, Beecham said. As time went on, I gradually became more reconciled to my lonely life. Prior to my wife's illness, I had been a fairly regular attendant at church, but after her death, I ceased to go. My wife was so kind and gentle and wholly good that I could not imagine how God could allow her to suffer so much, or suffer at all. I lost all faith in God. Father Michael sighed. So many have, he exclaimed sympathetically. And yet there must be some good reason for our having to suffer so much in this life. It may well be that those who suffer most will be compensated most. If we did not endure pain and sorrow in this world, we could not experience real happiness in the life to come. How very boring everlasting happiness in this world would be. No more boring than everlasting happiness in heaven, which is what the scriptures tell us the good people in this world will experience. I much prefer boredom to suffering. I've had more than my share of suffering. Pain purges, my son, Father Michael piously remarked, and there can be no heaven if the soul is in any way tarnished. One mustn't question the justice of God. He knows what is necessary and best for man. Beecham made no comment, but it was easy to see from his expression that he was not in agreement with Father Michael. Let me continue my story, he said after a brief silence. Last May, I went for a walking tour in Brittany with my friend Charles Lestrange. One day, we arrived at a village called Louisville and inquired of the landlord of the only inn the way to Rennes. We intended to spend the night there. He told us that there was two ways of getting to that place, one rather longer than the other, but strongly advised us to take the longer. We asked him why, and after a little hesitation, he said, because the shorter way was through a wood which bore a very sinister reputation. Knowing how superstitious the Bretons, especially the peasants, are, we asked him jokingly if the wood was haunted, but he wouldn't say yes or no, inferring from his reticence that he believed the wood was haunted. We set off gaily, fully resolved, just for the fun of it, to take the shorter route. By the time we came to the wood, it was getting dusk. The wood, which stretched far away on either side of us, looked somehow forbidding with its dense foliage and dark, weird shadows. After deliberating for a while whether it would not be advisable to retrace our steps and go by the longer route after all, we finally entered the wood. The sepulchral stillness was every now and then broken by the flutter of a leaf, the creaking and crunching of undergrowth beneath the tread of some four-footed prowler of the night, the rustling of foliage by birds scared at our approach, and the dismal hooting of an owl. The path was so full of ruts and overgrown in places with brambles and rank vegetation that we couldn't proceed fast for fear of stumbling. After feeling our way with difficulty for nearly an hour, we were startled to see a little distance ahead of us a tall figure in gleaming white. We at once thought of the warning which the landlord of the inn had given us about the wood, and came to an abrupt halt. Ashamed at our cowardice, we soon, however, pushed on and were relieved and amused to find that what we had taken for a ghost was only a tree. Standing in the center of a clearing, its white bare trunk presented a singularly blasted appearance. We were both so tired with our long and arduous tramp that we decided to camp out in the clearing. The tree had a curious fascination for me, and I proposed sleeping under its wide-spreading branches, one of which resembled a long bony arm with a great hand poised as if in the act of clutching hold of someone. You sleep under the tree if you like, Lestrange told me, but I won't. To me there is something horribly evil about it. I laughed at him and told him not to be so silly, but I couldn't make him change his mind, and it ended in my making my bed under the tree while he lay out in the open. I shall never forget that night. I had a succession of horrible nightmares. No sooner did I awake in a cold sweat of terror from my one nightmare than I fell asleep and had an even worse one. I was only too thankful when morning came. On rising from the ground, I was distinctly conscious of a great change in me. I was not the same man. Thoughts that had hitherto been foreign to my nature surged through me. Lestrange was shocked at my conversion, at the terms I used, and the views I expressed.
and he was by no means narrow-minded. He attributed the difference in me to the tree, and I have strong grounds for believing that he was right. From what we subsequently learned, Father, the tree bore a very evil reputation. More than one person had been found dead hanging from one of its branches, and several mysterious murders had taken place in close proximity to it. The change in me was not for that one night only. It was a durable change, entailing a process of general demoralization. I am afraid of myself, Father, fearful of the harm I may do to my daughter, whom I love so much. I don't fancy that I'm possessed. I know I am possessed, obsessed and possessed by the beastly spirit that was attached to that tree. I wonder, Father Michael exclaimed, you don't think it is just your imagination, do you? It seems so utterly fantastic. Beecham shook his head. I expected that you might say something like that, but I assure you that it is not my imagination. I am positively certain that an evil spirit has got hold of me, and I dread the consequences unless you or someone else will rid me of it. Beecham spoke with such heartfelt emotion, and there was much an appealing expression in his eyes that Father Michael was greatly moved. The more he studied Beecham, the more puzzled he became. He could not make up his mind if the man was mad. After much deliberation, he said, "If it will comfort you and ease your mind, I will try and rid you of the spirit which you believe is influencing you so much." When he spoke about the exorcism taking place at his church, Beecham objected. He said that he was particularly anxious for the ceremony to be carried out in his own house. Father Michael protested, but in the end gave way, realizing the probability of Beecham having some peculiar reason for such a request. "I must warn you, however," he added, "that there may be some danger in performing the act in a private dwelling place." "I am prepared to risk that," Beecham exclaimed. "I'm not afraid." "The danger may not be so great for you," Father Michael said, "as for someone else. Do you remember in the 8th chapter of St. Matthew how the devils, when cast out of the two men by our Lord, went into a herd of swine? While in case of exorcism, it is extremely important that no third person should be present during the ceremony. Will you promise that you will take every precaution to ensure our being quite alone in your house?" Beecham promised. "There will only be myself in the house," he said. "I'll arrange for my daughter and housekeeper to be out for the night." They fixed a day and hour, and Beecham went away greatly relieved. The night chosen for the occasion proved to be close and sultry. Ominous clouds hung low in the sky, and far-off rumblings were every now and then heard. True to his word, Beecham was alone in the house, momentarily expecting the arrival of Father Michael. Elise was spending the evening with friends, and Mrs. Chandler, the housekeeper, had gone to her daughter-in-law's home in a neighboring village. The house in which Beecham lived was very suitable for the occasion. It stood alone on the fringe of the village, separated from the nearest house by a stream and a quarry. Facing it, on the far side of the road, was a spinney, containing mostly fir trees. Beecham glanced impatiently at the clock. He hated unpunctuality. Father Michael was already 5 minutes late. Beecham was pacing up and down on the floor in a state of extreme irritability when the garden gate clicked. Footsteps came hurriedly up the path, and there was a knock on the front door. It was the priest, red in the face from hurrying on such a warm night and much out of breath. "I am sorry that I am late," he panted, "but I had a visitor who would stay talking." A room in the rear of the house had been prepared for the ceremony. Elise and Mrs. Chandler were led to believe that it was merely for a church service. Father Michael, endeavoring to overcome the feeling of fear that gripped him when he and Beecham were together in the room, the only human beings in the house, solemnly began the rites which the Roman Catholic Church had ordained for the occasion. Beecham, standing before him, was ghastly pale, the tightening of his lips and heaving of his breast evincing the intense emotional struggle that was taking place within him. From outside there came at intervals the rumbling of distant thunder and the whining and yelping of a dog. As he proceeded, Father Michael was conscious of a feeling of expectancy in the atmosphere of the room, of a tensing and sense of extraordinary concentration, suggestive of the near advent of some supernatural occurrence. An accompanying change was visible in Beecham. The muscles in his face twitched convulsively. The heavings of his breast grew more and more violent. His eyes gleamed, and his expression became so wholly evil and menacing that Father Michael recoiled in horror. Striving to remain calm, he sprinkled Beecham with holy water, pronouncing as he did so sacramental words and adjuring the evil spirit which he knew was possessing Beecham in the name of the Holy Trinity, to come out of the man and leave the house and grounds. As he uttered the words, a shadowy form slowly emerged from Beecham. Father Michael could never have believed that even in hell there was anything so appallingly foul and frightful. Immeasurably shocked, he watched it as it passed swiftly and noiselessly across the floor and through the doorway, out into the garden where it vanished. Beecham, who did not see it, sank pale and exhausted into a chair. Father Michael remained with him until he had recovered and then went home. Beecham left the neighborhood a few weeks after the exorcism and returned to Dublin, his native city. He married again, was very happy, and ever grateful to Father Michael for having so successfully exorcised the evil spirit that had possessed him. Perks the Obsessed. One of the strangest cases of intercourse with dangerous evil spirits and obsession by them is related in a letter sent to the Bishop of Gloucester by the Reverend Arthur Bedford, who was vicar of Temple Parish, Bristol, at the beginning of the 18th century. Mr. Bedford said that while he was curate to Dr. Reed, rector of St. Nicholas in the city of Bristol, he became acquainted with Thomas Perks, a steady, studious young man who lived with his father at Mangotsfield, Gloucestershire. Perks told him that he had recently been studying Cornelia Agrippa's fourth book of occult philosophy, in which there was a formula for raising spirits. He said that out of curiosity he went one night to the crossroads, about 1.25 miles from Frenchay, and in obedience to the instructions in the formula made a circle on the ground with consecrated chalk. When he had done this, he stood in the center of the circle with a lighted lantern on one side of him and a lighted consecrated candle on the other side. He then repeated several incantations from the formula and invoked any spirits that might be present to manifest. Nothing happened for some minutes, and then suddenly a number of tiny pretty girls appeared and danced around the circle. He said that he was frightened until he remembered that no harm would befall him so long as he remained within the circle. In response to his question as to whether there was a heaven and a hell, one of the spirits said that both these places actually existed. He asked her what hell was like. She said that it was a very dreadful place full of horrible spirits and begged him never to refer to it again. She told him that the class of spirits to which she and her companions belonged had its headquarters in the air, that there was a supreme chief or ruler who had a permanent court and counselors, and that there were three orders, each of which had specific functions. Spirits of the first order were transmitters of messages to and from the spirits functioning on the earth. Spirits belonging to the second order were bearers of those messages to and from the earth. Spirits of the third order functioned on the earth according to the directions that they received from the supreme chief. Perks said that at his request, the little spirits sang to him from behind a bush. Their voices were curiously shrill and resembled the voices of old women. When they had finished singing, they emerged from behind the bush, and after conversing for a short time with Perks, they abruptly vanished. Mr. Bedford said he told Perks that he thought that he had done very wrong in invoking the spirits, as it was contrary to the teaching in the Bible. Perks disagreed and said the spirits that he had invoked were perfectly harmless, and that he intended going to the crossroads again to try and obtain a familiar spirit that would come when he wanted it and always do his bidding. He wanted Mr. Bedford and a Mr. Bailey to accompany him to the crossroads and witness his invocation, but they both declined. Mr. Bedford did not see him again for several months, and when he next encountered him, he looked ill and in great trouble. He told Mr. Bedford that he had gone to the crossroads again one night, taking with him the various things that were mentioned in Agrippa's book for invoking a familiar spirit. After he had made a circle on the ground, he invoked any spirit present to appear. The minute passed without anything happening, and he was thinking of going home, when a strange figure of a vague, indefinite form suddenly appeared and informed him that its name was Malachi and that it was his familiar spirit. It bade Perks enter its name on the first page of a little book that was among the things which Perks had been instructed to bring with him. It also enjoined him to inscribe in the book the names of all the spirits that would appear that night and on subsequent occasions, and told him that whenever he wished it to come to him, he had only to open the book at the page on which its name was entered. Soon after Malachi had given him these instructions, other spirits appeared. Some of them resembled savage beasts of prey and other things that he had seen in nightmares. They hissed and made horrible grimaces at him, and had he not been well within the consecrated circle, they would have undoubtedly attacked him. They kept moving round and round the circle until daybreak, when they all vanished. Perk said that he had never felt well after that night at the crossroads and that he constantly had a feeling that evil spirits were close to him, although he could not see them and had never made any compact with them. He expressed great repentance for having invoked spirits. Mr. Bedford bade him pray earnestly for deliverance from satanic influences and advise him to see a doctor without delay. His advice, however, came too late. Perks died within a few weeks. His death was believed to have been due to the fright he endured the night he invoked Malachi. He was only 21 years of age. The book by means of which Perks claimed he had invoked spirits passed into the possession of Mr. William Llewellyn, who was present at his funeral. What subsequently became of the book is not recorded. One day in June 1760, Mr. Joseph Beck and a friend who had heard extraordinary rumors about spirit raising in the past by this man named Perks paid a visit to the crossroads where the invocations were alleged to have taken place. There they found an old man, a native of Franchet, repairing a stone wall. The old man told them that his name was Primble and that he remembered hearing about Perks in his youth. He said he knew several men who were able to do wonderful things through having invoked spirits at those particular crossroads. A man named Cole was one of them. He said he went one evening to a public house near Franchet. Cole and several other men were in the tap room. Cole told them that if they would sit quite still and not move a limb, he would give them a convincing proof of his magical powers. They laughed and were skeptical, but promised to keep very quiet. Cole then stood in a corner of the room with his back towards all the company. He took something out of one of his pockets, and immediately afterwards they saw by the light of the candles in the room a tree about 3 feet in height rise from the center of the floor. Presently, two little men in short coats and red cape appeared. They began to cut down the tree with great skill and celerity. As soon as the tree had been felled and the little men had gathered up the chips that were strewn about the floor, men, tree, and chips vanished simultaneously. Brimble told Mr. Beck and his companion that he and everyone who had witnessed the extraordinary exhibition were convinced that it was supernatural, and that Cole was no trickster but a genuine magician. Mr. Beck inquired if there had been any invocations at the crossroads recently. Brimble said that he was not aware there had been any within the last 10 years. The crossroads, he added, were so horribly haunted by evil spirits that no one ventured to pass them alone after nightfall. He told them that he was going home very shortly and advised them not to linger there after he had gone, as it would soon be getting dusk. They took his advice and went. Riders from Hell. The following account of a strange fox hunter is taken from letters by the late Lord Lyttelton, Volume 1, page 141, London, dated 1787. The members of a well-known hunting club were engaged in a chase one day, when a stranger of singularly aristocratic appearance joined them. No one knew him or had any idea whence he came, and strange to say, no one inquired. He was well mounted and rode with a degree of courage and daring that astonished everyone. His horse was amazingly powerful. Nothing stopped it. It left the huntsman far behind. He swore that it came from hell and that its rider was the devil. When the chase was over, the members of the hunt club invited the stranger to dinner. He accepted the invitation and surprised his host as much by his eloquence, knowledge, and manners as he had done by his horsemanship. He was an orator, poet, painter, musician, lawyer, and a divine. In short, he was everything. And the magic of his conversation kept the hunters awake and enthralled long after their customary bed hour. At length, however, wearied nature could be charmed no more, and the hunters began to steal away by degrees to their repose. The stranger manifested great uneasiness when he observed the company diminish, and exerted himself to the utmost to maintain the interest of his depleted audience. He succeeded, but only for a short time. Soon after, everyone had retired to rest, the household was alarmed by the next horrible shrieks. There was silence for a time, and then the shrieking was renewed and was even more dreadful than previously. Horrible groans of despair succeeded the shrieks and were followed by blood-curdling yells of pain and terror. The listeners, hunters, and domestics were appalled. The more courageous of them went in a body to the stranger's room, from whence the sounds proceeded, and knocked loudly at his door. He declared angrily that he had heard no noise and told them not to disturb him. They had hardly returned to their respective rooms when there was a renewal of the yells, shrieks, and groans, which seemed to issue from the throats of a score or more of damned, tortured souls. The listeners followed the sounds and traced them without a shadow of a doubt to the stranger's room, the door of which they burst open. They found the stranger upon his knees on the bed in the act of scourging himself with the most relentless severity, his body streaming with blood. On their seizing his hand to arrest the strokes, he begged them to leave him, assuring them that the cause of the disturbance was over, and that in the morning he would explain the reason of the terrible cries that they had heard and the revolting sight that they had seen. After he had pleaded with them for some time, they left him and retired to bed. In the morning, some of the hunters went to the stranger's room. He was not there. On examining his bed, they found it soaked with blood. One of the club grooms told them that as soon as it was light, the strange gentleman came to the stables booted and spurred and wanted his horse to be saddled at once. Directly this was done, he vaulted into the saddle and rode out of the yard at full speed. Servants were at once dispatched into every part of the county, but not a trace of the strange hunter could be found. He had not been seen by anyone, and his identity was never discovered. Robert Hunt, a friend of my father, used to relate a story, the truth of which he vouched for, about a phantom horsewoman who haunted a district in the southwest of Ireland. John Burke, a relative of Robert Hunt, was out with the Blankentown hounds one day when he heard a cry for help. He rode at once in the direction of the cry and found the small boy trying to extricate a sheep which had gotten tangled in a bush. Burke, who was the kindest fellow in the world, dismounted and quickly liberated the silly animal. By the time he had done this and remounted, he discovered to his chagrin that the entire field had disappeared. He rode in the direction that he fancied they had taken and after a while realized that he had lost his way. He was debating what to do when he saw a woman mounted on a very glossy black horse riding a little way ahead of him. She wore green riding costume and a broad-brimmed hat with a long drooping feather. Wondering why she was wearing such a queer habit and who on earth she was, he had not seen her at the meet. Burke tried to overtake her, but no matter how fast he rode, the distance between the lady and himself always remained the same, yet without any apparent increase in her speed. He was strangely attracted by her. She had a slender, graceful figure and sat her horse marvelously well. He could not see her face, but he had the impression that it was beautiful. Her horse moved with a curious gliding motion. Its hoofs made no noise. Burke thought it must be due to the softness of the soil after the recent heavy rain. On and on the lady rode with Burke, always at the same distance behind her. The land grew more and more barren and desolate. Large gray boulders strewed the ground on either side of the narrow track along which they were careering. Here and there were the gnarled, fantastically fashioned trunks of dead and scantily leafed trees. The salty tang of the sea was in the air. Burke saw to his horror that the lady in front of him was rapidly approaching a cliff, far below which stretched the sea, glittering brightly in the moonbeams. He shouted a warning to the lady, but she made no apparent attempt to check her speed and rode recklessly on. His horse, as if magnetized, tore after her. When close to the brink of the cliff, she turned round and for the first time disclosed her face. It was indescribably lovely and wicked. Smiling archly at Burke, she beckoned to him to follow her and disappeared over the cliff. Finding it impossible to curb his horse, Burke uttered a fervent prayer and threw himself from the saddle. He fell heavily and lost consciousness. When he recovered, he staggered to his feet, badly shaken but not injured, and looked over the cliff. The moonlight revealed his horse lying dead on the jagged, naked rocks. There was no sign anywhere of the lovely, wicked lady or her horse. How he had got home, Burke never knew. He had not lived long enough in the Blanktown Hunt country to hear the story of the phantom lady of death. About the middle of the 18th century, a certain James Fennel bought an estate in the Blanktown Hunt country. He spent much of his time abroad and on one occasion came home with a beautiful foreign lady. He said that she was his wife, but it was generally believed that she was his mistress. He was known to have had quite a number of mistresses. She was an excellent horsewoman and was often seen mounted on a splendid black horse riding in the vicinity of the Fennel estate. Violent quarrels were reported to take place frequently between Fennel and the lady, and when she mysteriously disappeared, rumors of foul play were circulated. A year after her disappearance, Fennel and his horse were found one day lying on the seashore at the foot of the high cliff bordering the beach with their necks broken. It was surmised that the horse had taken fright at something and, getting out of control, had leaped over the cliff. After Fennel's death, a phantom rider believed to be the ghost of his foreign mistress was seen from time to time careering over the Blanktown Hunt country. Its appearance always presaged a tragedy. After Burke's miraculous escape, which, like a good Catholic, he attributed to his prayer, the phantom lady of death was never seen again.